Welcome, Gabriel, to your session of Applied Statistics. And I just did the introduction of that this is a sort of data reduction of larger data sets. And today it's also images, which I think is, well, it's something we haven't touched upon. So it's good to sort of get to see at least two-dimensional data in the form of image. But I think I'll just leave it to you, Gabriel, from here. And I'm recording,
okay.
Just so you know. We'll put that up afterwards. And when you're done with the lecture, I might say a few things, but then you also get to introduce the exercise. And then we take a long break and, well, then we start the exercise. Cool.
Okay, thank you, Charles. Let me start the sharing here.
For once, I'm also very excited to see what today's lecture is. Usually it's not a surprise, but it is today.
Well, it's a total surprise, yes, because it's just coming together. But thanks for giving me the opportunity. And I guess I can't see anybody here, but it's nice to see a number at the top and all of you out there. Sorry, I couldn't see you in person, of course. But yeah, my name is Gabriel Brammer. I'm an associate professor in the Cosmic Dawn Center at NBI. So I think there are some of your classmates are students in the center there. But we are a general research center that's focused on understanding the most distant galaxies and galaxy evolution across cosmic time. And we're doing that in a variety of ways. But what I'll show here is some of the kind of details of the work that I do in particular and some of the students and postdocs that I work with. And so showing some science highlights of kind of how this some of the results that come out of these types of data, but giving you a little bit of more detailed information about actually where that where those measurements come from in terms of these issues of data reduction and analysis, sort of like Jules mentioned at the beginning there. And also in the context of some of the tools that you've been learning throughout the course this semester. So some of you may have even seen this presentation. I gave a similar presentation to the Physics Stirna group last year, I think it was. So if you have, bear with me, but I always like to start with an image like this because I think it's particularly beautiful, and you may have seen other images like this of essentially a blank field of sky that has been observed with the Hubble Space Telescope. And what you see, you can see many different things in these types of images. So I don't know, can you see my mouse if I move around there, the pointer?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So you've got, when you take a telescope image of the skies, clearly you see a projected view of the sources on the sky. So some sources are nearby, some sources are far away. Some are stars in our own galaxy, like this big white thing at the left with these spikes here are diffraction spikes from the telescope optics. That's how you can generally tell the stars. So that's relatively nearby, but you've got everything in between from these nearby stars to some of the most distant galaxies in the universe that are currently known. And so really the name of this game in this very, it's kind of a classic astronomy in the sense that you just take images and you make pretty simple measurements of the statistics of these images to try to detect and characterize the most distant sources. Counting sources, for example, is still a ongoing, active field of active research, just simple sources. But in this image, there are, again, these nearby things, but there's also, one of the most distant galaxies known. And if you kind of scan across, maybe you can pick it out. If you see me show this, you know where it is. But this little red smudge down here in the lower right is kind of what the type of what these types of galaxies look like that I'll talk about throughout the talk. Like the most distant galaxies that we can observe and detect with Hubble, say 95% across the observable universe looking back towards the Big Bang. So if I zoom in on that, there's this little red smudge there, which is this very distant object. I'll use this term throughout. Forgive me if you haven't seen it before, but you'll see this variable Z appear in various places. That's what we call the redshift, or it's a measure of basically how much the light from this distant galaxy has been stretched by the expansion of the universe. And it's essentially a measure of the distance to the galaxy, or to these near background objects. And so just to contrast that with a very nearby object, this is a galaxy not too far from the Milky Way. This is not our own Milky Way, of course. We're sitting inside the disk of a galaxy that looks probably a lot like this if you could fly up, 20,000 parsecs above it. But a redshift z of zero is kind of defined to be today. And then so this redshift is kind of it's both a distance and also a time clock in a sense, because of the finite speed of light. It takes a finite amount of time for the light to travel from these distant objects to us. And so as we see these very distant things, we're seeing them as they were in the past, in this case, some 12 billion years ago, where the age of the universe today is something like 13.7 billion years, 13.5. So that goes back to, some of the work by Hubble, the astronomer, Hubble the man. There's a picture of him with his pipe there, where he used galaxies nearby to establish this fact that the space is, the universe is expanding, the space is expanding. So, to put that in a little more general context, there are other observations of the distant universe that can be made. At the top is, essentially a purely almost purely statistical measurement. This is a map of the cosmic microwave background fluctuations. So if you look in the microwave, basically anywhere in the sky, and you, with a very sensitive instrument, you see these tiny variations in the temperature of this. It's basically a relic of the hot Big Bang. Now it's only about 2 Kelvin, but it's a relic of when the very hot early universe. And these very small temperature fluctuations correspond to matter distribution fluctuations in the early universe. And it's essentially a matter of making a power spectrum of that map and plotting that histogram. And I won't go into any more detail on this, but just to show, again, there's a lot of kind of more pure physics and pure statistics in this. But the data points here are the red points that, and you can almost, it's hard to almost see the difference with this gray model underneath it, which is the kind of current, what's called the concordance model of the overall geometry and properties of the universe. So that's an extremely successful model for explaining basically the basic geometry of the universe. And so then the challenge is to connect sort of these observations of the very early universe. Here it's about a redshift of 1100, or only 100,000 years after the Big Bang, to the properties today, where if you go out with a survey and you observe a large area of the sky, you see that the sky is filled with galaxies that look kind of like these at below. So the name of the game is kind of connecting these primordial matter fluctuations into the structures like our own Milky Way that we see today. Okay, so back to this picture, and again, just to make this point that in a given image, you have galaxies projected on the sky. So you have this object and kind of behind everything else here, redshift 9.5. You also have these intermediate objects at kind of more intermediate redshifts. Redshift of one corresponds to about maybe 7 billion years ago. And then all these kind of orangish galaxies are actually objects in a single massive cluster of galaxies. They're all at about the same distance. And they can actually magnify the light coming from behind them, and with gravitational lensing, which is why this particular field was observed. And then, so in this sort of counting exercise, you first take these images, you have to then characterize these galaxies, estimate their distances. I'll say more about how that's done. Measure their brightnesses. You can determine, estimate, for example, how quickly they're forming stars. And then you can make a plot sort of like this, which is just on the y-axis, you see the star formation rate of averaged over the universe. You take lots of these images and you just basically average them over a large volume. And you plot that number, the star formation rate, as a function of redshift. And you basically have the growth and, the growth history of stars in the universe. It starts, so the Big Bang is on the right side of this plot. So time goes from right to left. You have this rapid buildup where things are first turning on, and then it kind of reaches this peak of redshift 2 and then tails off. So, there's a lot of, information here on how galaxies form and evolve. I'm not going to go into, but just to show you how, essentially just counting numbers with fairly simple measurements, is how we kind of infer this overall history of galaxies and their evolution in the universe. Okay. So let's see, that wasn't supposed to show that, but I'll want to talk a little bit about some of these images then that we use to measure. Basic, like I've been saying, kind of astronomy, or what I mean by that is just essentially, measurement of these images, rather not so much astrophysics at this level. But in a basic sense, it's done with these 2D images that sample the projected brightness distribution of sources on the sky. So here's a a plate that Edwin Hubble, you know, used in back in 1923 with photographic emulsion, you know, like film photography. But now with the Hubble telescope, of course, we have, you know, very sensitive, and other telescopes, we have very sensitive digital detectors that are essentially linear photon counting devices. That by linear, I mean that, you know, they have a linear response with more and more flux. You just get more signal on the detector, and they can be calibrated to, for example, a pretty absolute, you know, a relatively precise absolute scale, say energy per unit, you know, surface falling on the detector. There's a lot of details there that I won't go into, but the point is that, you know, they're very low noise, very efficient and calibratable detectors that are on telescopes like Hubble, flying in space. So just a few basic statistics on how these observations work. I just wanted to go through this to make a point that I think is relevant when you're talking about telescope observations, and you'll see some of this in the exercise. But just a very simple equation, which is basically the signal that you measure on your detector is the sum of both the signal from the sources that you're interested in, like these galaxies. There's also this factor B, or the background, which is maybe a diffuse background that just kind of raises the overall pedestal level of the image. I put quotes around it because it's actually probably a foreground. It's more like, you know, light in our solar system, kind of reflected light from dust in our solar system just kind of adds this background. So it's, you know, certainly it's in front of the distant galaxies, but it has the effect of raising the overall level of the image. And then in terms of the noise, you've got the noise characterization of these detectors. So there's this factor N times epsilon squared, where epsilon is just the read noise of the detector. There's electronics, there's some intrinsic noise with measuring the signal that's on the detector. And then where this the variable T there is just the integration time, the amount of time that you're basically collecting this signal. And if under Poisson signals, statistics of just photons hitting the detector, the variance of this signal is just the source plus the background times the time. That's the, you know, that's the Poisson component of the detected photons, plus this component of the read noise. And the reason I would just want to go through this, and I think it's kind of an interesting point to see, is that in the cases where the background is significantly greater than the source, which is actually the case for most of these observations, and also this read noise, because we have these efficient detectors, if you just kind of plug in the equations, you see that the signal to noise goes as a factor of the square root of time. And so that, you know, that's kind of the bane of a lot of our telescope observing efforts, because if you take an exposure for an hour and that has a particular noise level that allows you to see sources down to a particular brightness, and things that are fainter are just hidden in the noise. If you want to reduce that noise by a factor of two, it requires four times more integration time. So you'll see, you know, those types of numbers appear all over the place, probably in the, you know, the accelerator information, you know, just kind of counting statistics. But that's just something to remember, that it gets kind of really expensive to, once you invest a particular amount of time, to make your images much deeper beyond some threshold anyway. And then I just wanted to make this connection to something I think you learned in one of the first lectures of the class, that, you know, we take many exposures with these detectors to, you know, to build up this integration time, and you're kind of relying on effectively the central limit theorem to, and that gives you, because you've got many measurements of basically a single source that's not necessarily varying in time, that typically gives you Gaussian statistics of the, you know, the image qualities, the pixel values, if you want to call it that. But it's, you know, that's part of this issue of calibration and also data reduction, is that you want to both verify that that's true, and you'll see that in the exercise, but also you want to preserve that, you know, you want to keep track of all of these uncertainties as you're doing this various, these exercises of data reduction and data processing, that you don't sort of corrupt, you know, this kind of pristine noise of, on the detectors. So here's an example of just how this integration works. At the top, you see just a couple, on the left are the little footprints of this detector on a particular position on the sky. You'll see that why that position is important later. But at the top is this integration with Hubble of about 10 minutes. And then if you, you know, build up more exposures by just kind of just moving, you know, pointing the telescope many times at a single position on the sky and building up time on a single position, you see that the noise, you know, goes down by this expected factor of square root of t. So in 2 hours, you see fainter sources emerge. And then by the time you're at 9 hours, which is kind of not cheap, but on, you know, kind of expensive in terms of what a Hubble integration is. It's not the longest integration, but that's kind of characteristic of a deep, what you call integration with Hubble. You see these faint sources really emerge out of the noise where you didn't see them in the first, you know, in single exposures. So that's essentially just stacking them, these images together, and weighting by the uncertainties. So, you know, the shapes of these images is kind of governed by the telescope optics. I'm just going to introduce this briefly. This is, you know, its own topic for an astronomy class, but just to point it out, that, you know, a star in these images has, you know, if you had an infinitely large telescope, well, you might be able to actually resolve a star, but stars are so far away that they're essentially point sources as viewed from Earth. They have very small angular sizes. They have a finite size in the image just because of the size of the telescope you're using. And we typically call that the point spread function, or how a point is imaged on the detector. And that you may recall with this kind of early kind of embarrassment with Hubble was that there was a problem with the mirror, that the mirror was basically the wrong shape, had been ground to the wrong shape. And it was, you know, the PSF was basically bigger than it should have been, and galaxy images and star images were blurry. That was quickly fixed by the astronauts back in the early 90s and kind of was able to realize this, you know, beautiful image quality that you can get from space with Hubble. So just as an aside there. And so we'll see in the notebook, I just wanted to give a very brief example of how you then take these images, which are just this 2D picture of the projected image of the sky, and can, you know, use this first, the point spread function, but also use these, the maps that you have to, you know, make statistical detections of sources on these images. And this equation that I show here is just, it's essentially a least squares fit. If you you have two images, one is which is the intensity coming from the detector, and you also have an image which is the you know, your estimate of the uncertainty of that measurement. Sorry. And then if you this is pretty much just the least squares equation, that you convolve the source divided by the variance times PSF in this equation, and that gives you an image that's basically fitting a PSF to every position in the image, and it gives you essentially the signal to noise if there was a point source at that position in the image. So you can use that to make a signal to noise map of the image and threshold that to detect sources. Okay, so you'll see that in the example. But just a point I wanted to make is, and I think you've seen this elsewhere in statistical tests, but in this type of exercise, I just want to say that you have to be careful. And this comes up in other places, and it'll come up again at the end, just because these large images effectively have, you know, give you many trials for detecting sources. So remember, these are 2D images. So, you know, if you have 1,000 pixels on a side, that's already 1 million pixels. You might have a few million, what you might call resolution elements, where you could detect a star in these images in a single exposure. So a typical, you know, statistical threshold of 3 sigma, or like, you know, p of 0.1, if you've got 10 million potential positions for sources, can still give you a very big number of spurious sources. So you just have to be careful, and just remember when you're talking about these types of analyses to consider, you know, how many, you know, trials are there if you're adopting a statistical threshold of 1%, but you've got a sample of, you know, 1 million, then you're likely to have a fairly large in absolute sense number of potential contaminants or false positives. And that's all, even for pure Gaussian statistics, it gets worse if there are systematics that you don't understand. So that's really the name of the big challenge, is both, you know, understanding the Gaussian statistics and also understand the systematics. Okay. And so here in the exercise, there's an example on what I call segmentation. So that's just taking, you know, you make these thresholds on the images, and then you have to just make some decision for what you want to call a single object. And, you know, there's a lot of details in that, but this, you'll see an example of how to do that, that with this type of segmentation algorithms, you can basically, you know, threshold these images and break them up into discrete sources. And then from that, you measure perhaps moments of the light distribution. So for example, the sum of all the light of an object within its segment, maybe some other moments like the full width, half max, or the distribution. And that's really kind of the end of this kind of data reduction part, where you've taken all these individual exposures, you've averaged a bunch of them together to make a final mosaic. Then you measure moments of that image for individual sources. And so, you know, what might have been many, you know, gigabytes of image data downloaded from Hubble might turn into even a single measurement if it's a single galaxy you're interested in its brightness or other properties of its light distribution. And so you can then go with the telescope and measure not just a single, sort of take a single image, but if you can measure different, the intensity of these sources as a function of wavelength to provide kind of a third dimension for characterizing them. And so in this example is just there are a filter wheel and these detectors that just, they're just little pieces of glass that only pass particular wavelengths of light. And you just take different images in those filters, and that allows you to measure basically the brightness of the different objects as a function of wavelength. And so if you do that in this particular example, now you see one of these little red blips appear like I was showing before. So that just means that it's brightest in this red channel at 1.6 microns. And it's essentially invisible already at 1 micron. So that's why it appears so red. And then, you know, the distribution of colors in this image is kind of effectively a distribution of redshifts, though at a given redshift, galaxies can also have different colors. That's the measurement. And so that's basically how this works for finding these very distant objects, is that looking for basically the reddest things you can find in the image. And the reason this works is because all the neutral hydrogen in the universe between us and these distant galaxies absorbs light below a rest frame, I should say, 1216 angstroms. This is the Lyman alpha transition. And so, you know, all of this hydrogen basically absorbs all of the photons bluer than that limit. And the effect is that it creates this step function signal in these distant galaxies, that they're essentially invisible below 1200 angstroms, but then you can detect them at wavelengths longer than that. And so the, you know, to find these particular objects, the technique is really just to observe a field in many and find basically what is the bluest filter in which a given object disappears, it becomes invisible. And that way that the wavelength of that bandpass filter roughly corresponds to this particular rest frame wavelength, which you can turn into a redshift. So it's a very crude, but actually quite effective way for measuring the estimating the distances to these very distant objects. Okay, and so just some comments on, you know, what I've said so far, and in the context of, I think what you've talked about already a little bit in the context of machine learning, of course, that appears in many different places these days. But just to point out that this exercise of data reduction, you know, these procedures that I've mentioned are done as objectively and statistically motivated as possible, but they of course inevitably involve data compression and loss of information. The compression is usually by design. You don't necessarily need to carry around 10 gigabytes of data for this one measurement, but you need to be aware of that. But I just wanted to make a point that the, you know, these image moments, like the total brightness of the galaxy or other moments of the light distribution, essentially just features that a machine or you, the researcher, has chosen as important. But, you know, that's basically how, you know, a lot of the machine learning works, is you can imagine just turning a machine loose on the raw data and letting it decide what the important features are. They might be other more, you know, different moments of the light distribution, for example. And so there are trade-offs between both the speed that and efficiency that a machine can do this, you know, evaluating many, many objects very quickly, perhaps a trade-off with interpretability. You have to figure out a way to interpret what the machine then tells you. But that's been used pretty successfully already, even fairly recently in this field, where these researchers in this link shown below, rather than making these kind of high, these low order moment measurements of the images, they just make little cutouts of the image of nearby galaxies in these different filters, and just feed the images themselves directly to the machine, let the machine figure out what the, you know, how the various aspects of the light distribution translate. In this case, the labels are the distance or the redshift to these galaxies. And that's very successful because, you know, they, in these particular cases, they have very large and comprehensive training sets that can use it. It doesn't work as well for the most distant galaxies. But in general, I think there's a lot to be done in astronomy as well as all the other fields that perhaps you've already seen, already some in the class, about letting machines kind of figure out what are the important features of these data. Okay, so I'll just kind of finish with a little bit of science on this source that has appeared now a few times. This is the galaxy, and you'll see it in the exercise, is this galaxy that originally was identified as a candidate at a redshift of 10, which would have made it the most distant object known, shown here in this red blip. And you know, you can now appreciate kind of what the challenges is of this, is that when you have this image, it's a, you know, a very big image with thousands of galaxies, and you have to pick out the one you know, that's this most distant object using the tools like I've shown before. And so if you plot the spectral energy distribution, or how the brightness of the galaxy in these different filters as a function of wavelength, you see exactly this step function like I was saying before. So it's detected here at about 1.6 microns, like we saw earlier, but it's essentially invisible, or it drops out of all these, all the bluer filters. And that's consistent with a redshift of about 10. Okay, and the gray curve here is a perhaps more exotic, but much more nearby galaxy shape that could potentially explain the same type of shape of the colors, though in detail it doesn't explain the data as well as the high redshift solution. Okay. So that was the result in 2015 that Pascal Osch, who's actually a faculty member that will be joining Dawn later this year, discovered this object. But then we went back and took a spectrum of it in 2016 to try to confirm the redshift of this source. And that the spectrum is shown here from Hubble. And so on the top is essentially the raw spectrum, the dispersed light. So it's wavelength going across the x-axis and the spatial dimension and the y-axis. But most of what you see here is just contamination from other objects in this image. So that's shown in the model in the bottom. If you subtract that, you're left with this little excess here that's consistent with this model of this very distant redshift 11. And so, you know, the point here is this is not a high signal to noise measurement. And so you're very sensitive to both trusting and interpreting the statistics of these images. And so I just wanted to show a couple of examples of how we did that. One simple test is just, if you want to do chi-squared tests and all these types of things, you want to ensure that the uncertainties are in fact normally distributed or Gaussian. So that seems to be true from these spectroscopic data. And then we also evaluate, how likely, can we select our model at redshift 11? Can we, is that favored statistically over, less exotic, lower redshift solutions? And that seems to be the case, that you can come up with a couple of different examples of things that it could be that could have similar color, shapes in the images, but they would have different spectra. And we can reject those at least the five sigma level. So you see the chi-squared here of the redshift 11 solution is about 1, the reduced chi-squared, whereas it's 15 and 67 for the other solution. So that's some of the evidence in favor of this thing being the distance that we think it is. So here's just a few statistics. So the distance is to this object about 13.4 billion light years, or only a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. Its radius, if you correct for how big is it observed on the image, you can turn that into a physical scale, turns into be about 2,500 light years across. The Milky Way is 25 times larger than that. So this thing is a very small seed of something that eventually perhaps evolves into the Milky Way. It has a mass of about a billion. That's pretty small as far as galaxies concerned. The Milky Way is perhaps 50 times larger than that. But it is forming stars at a rate of something like 25 times the mass of the sun, 25 suns per year, every year. And the Milky Way is not actually forming that many stars currently. It's mostly just stars that are existent places. The star formation rate of the Milky Way is 50 times lower. So these early seeds like this are, very different objects than the things that we see nearby. I'll just skip that. And to just give the motivation partly of why we try to, why we're doing all this. One is just to kind of extend this. This is the same plot that I showed before, but at the very distant end, the star formation rate is a function of redshift and how that evolves at the very earliest times. And there's some evidence that it kind of drops off at the very earliest times. And there's really a rapid expansion of the first stars turning on in the very first galaxies. So, you know, there's only about 5 or a half dozen of these sources known at redshift greater than 9 currently. So, you know, any one is already kind of a new measurement and a new way of probing this very distant universe. And eventually we hope to have more to be able to understand more of the distribution of their properties. So, you know, looking forward to the future, how this works, this is a figure that was come along with some of the early Hubble deep field images that, you know, Hubble keeps pushing this frontier further and further back, essentially as it adds new detectors and new capabilities to the telescope, essentially being able to see redder and redder wavelengths to see more higher and higher redshift galaxies. But the object that we've seen is essentially at the limit of what Hubble can see. If it was at any higher redshift, it would be invisible even to the reddest filter that Hubble can see. So that we're forced to, we're looking forward to the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope, which is the successor to Hubble, which is supposed to launch actually this year. We're at 2021, it's October of 2021. So we're looking forward to that launch to be able to really characterize and detect more objects like this. And just a kind of final point is just that you have to essentially event at the end of the day, you do this all automatically, because if you want to be able to find many objects like this, you have to be able to search large areas of the sky that Hubble has observed. So that's kind of this pipeline that you try to automate all this with all these considerations that I've shown before. So the one last aside, I just wanted to point out, this was a very recent result from December of last year, just a few weeks ago. Researchers reported the detection of a transient signal in the spectrum of as they were observing this particular source. Back in, 2017, I was trying to click the chat and I lost it. Just a second. Reported this potentially exciting discovery of something like a supernova or a gamma ray explosion in this particular object while they're observing it back in 2017. So it was already picked up at the end of last year by some popular media, a huge explosion in the oldest galaxy in the universe, for example. So here's the measurement of this. So here's the data. So this is a time series of, the data are a little bit different than I've been showing. These are spectra, dispersed spectra, but the time series is going from top to bottom here. And so in a spectrum up here, there's nothing in the first one, 207, 3 minutes later, there's nothing. 3 minutes later, boop, there's this blip that clicks on, which is they were potentially a supernova or gamma ray burst in this galaxy. And then 3 minutes later, it clicks off again. So this thing just flashed on and off. And there are examples of these types of explosions, these gamma ray bursts. Nothing at this very high redshift, but potentially at modest redshift. So if it was true, I think it would be extremely exciting. And the authors, did many tests to try to figure out what this is. So they had asked, is it clear that this particular signal is coming from above the atmosphere? That seems to be true based on the shape of the spectrum and some of the features seen in it. And then they tried to evaluate, well, what else could it be if it's not an explosion? Was it a satellite? No. But if you try to look at the website, it doesn't exist anymore. It's down. Was it a known asteroid? You can query NASA databases to see if there is a known asteroid in your field at a given time. Doesn't seem to be. So, you know, if those explanations are not true, then, you know, maybe it's a gamma ray burst just 400 million years after the Big Bang. And so I just put a cutout from their paper. You know, they evaluate, you know, the likelihood of this thing happening. And, you know, they calculate that, you know, given the fact that you're just staring at this thing and various aspects of the timing of it, they say, you know, the chance probability of catching this gamma ray burst or the explosion of a star in this galaxy be 0.3 to 60 times 10 to the minus 10 or something like 1 in a billion. So this probability is low, but it's higher than, you know, the other things that we don't think it's a satellite or an asteroid. So I think it's kind of interesting thing to show. I mean, you're talking about rejecting hypotheses at P of you know, 0.001 or something. This is many, many orders of magnitude off of that, but you know, it's what it is. But then, you know, just over Christmas, we were looking at this, and this is work that we're actively doing at some of us at Dawn, you know, and I should have been, or while I was, you know, eating Christmas dinner and the day after, I was looking at some of this. And, you know, it turns out that you can actually, if you look at the archival data from this instrument, I found at least 10 things that look kind of like it, and just different exposures, different parts of the sky. There's not anything particularly special about them. But I think it's just a pretty simple observation, just that, well, if you see 10 of them and they look the same, then obviously it can't be a one in a billion event that came from the, you know, from the early universe. And so I think that just the point here to make is that, it, you know, as you're doing all this model selection, model analysis, that, you know, you searched a database for a satellite, but it just wasn't in that database. So you say it's unlikely and it's impossible, but, you know, I think it's just kind of worth keeping in mind, you know, what these kind of numbers in the absolute sense mean, and also in terms of, you know, these P statistics and stuff that you've seen throughout the class. So with that, I want to stop there. And, you know, I think it's been a very brief introduction for what these images look like, but I hope you see some connections there with some of the other tools and techniques that you've learned throughout the class, and happy to take any questions from that.
Thank you very much, Gabriel. I think we should all quickly unmute, and thank you, Gabriel. So please join me.
Also to keep very cool.
Thank you.
Thanks, you, Gabriel.
All right. We actually have some questions on the way. I asked some and I tried to answer others, but it's all in the chat. So actually, if you put on the slides again.
Yeah.
We'll take a quick run through. And if you go way back to the star formation rate, the parabolic fit almost there.
Yeah.
What's the chi-square of that? It looks good.
Oh, that's a good question.
Maybe too good.
Yeah.
I wanted to be
clear. Yeah, I think so.
And suffered. Why is that not on there?
Yeah, that's a good question. This is not a physical model that's even shown on here. It's just an interpolating function that they've plotted.
Okay.
But some of that is, yeah, it's a good question. I mean,
all right.
I mean, they're very different measurements in many cases, but yeah, no, it's a good question. I agree with you.
And then on the background noise,
I don't think it's that far off from unity, but.
No, I was actually suspecting it to be too good and the errors were overestimated. And you could even tell each experiment if they were overestimating or underestimating their errors.
Yeah, that's a good.
All right,
that's a good point. I think
Norman, do you want to ask about the noise? A few slides further. Otherwise, I'll do that. What is the source of this background noise in S and B?
Here.
Yeah.
So S is just the count rate or photon rate of the sources that you're interested in, like a galaxy or a star or something, and B is a photon rate of this background, and I mean from the ground, the background is essentially, you know, thermal emission from the air around the telescope or the Earth or something. It's just diffuse light, or it's even thermal emission from the telescope itself. But in the case of Hubble, you're up above the atmosphere, so it's not really thermal emission or anything from the atmosphere, but it's actually generally reflected zodiacal light. So it's sunlight reflected off of dust in the solar system is essentially a diffuse component to any image that you take with Hubble. And so the noise is just the Poisson noise of the photons of this reflected solar light.
All right, and then I asked why the uncertainty on Z photon on the very, very far object was so large. And actually in a later slide, you showed the, you know, plus minus 0.4 when it's such a sharp drop off, but you show now 11.1 plus minus 0.1. That seemed more
reasonable. Yeah, the history was that, you know, the original measurement came from just these multi-band images that I was showing. So basically this very crude measurement of the spectrum from these bandpass filters that Hubble has taken. And so these filters, it's not actually shown on the plot here, but they're not monochromatic filters. They have a width. So so for example, this filter passes light from say 1.1 to 1.3 microns or something. And so in this case, the redshift uncertainty is just your inability to localize the exact location of the break within the filter bandpass. So okay. you can kind of shift the Lyman break back and forth within the width of the finite width of this filter. And that's essentially the redshift uncertainty.
The whole filter. Yeah. Okay.
And then it's smaller in the case of the spectrum, just because this is now an actual spectrum and not a bandpass filter, where you can essentially, you know, it's not, if you have a true spectrograph where you measure, say, an emission line, it's in two orders of magnitude smaller than this, because that's really a discrete wave, like a single wavelength plus or minus an angstrom or something. But well, here, it's better than the imaging, but it's still only as well localized as the noise of the spectrum. It's just the how much flexibility do you have in moving this break back and forth given the noise of the spectrum.
Okay, and on the next slide, you were testing for Gaussianity. The plot on the left, is that from your model or do you extract that from real data?
That's the residuals of the data minus model divided by the uncertainties.
Okay, so it's a pull plot, in fact. So it's really testing both also the uncertainties in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. And it's a pull between each pixel or what?
Yeah, okay. Exactly right. So, and that's related to this, you know, the reduction issues. Like, so there's often always just also a trade-off in that you have to have something to show, like making a plot. So often there's like additional data reduction in the sense of, you know, binning your images. And I know you've talked about binning in the class, whereas, you know, if you're actually, when you're fitting, you might do a maximum likelihood fit for parameters and things like that. But in order to show it, you have to plot a histogram, even though you're not generally fitting in the histogram space. So the same is true for these images. So the fits are actually done in the original space of all of the detector pixels of something like 50 individual exposures. And so, you know, the noise of this image here looks very much non-Gaussian. It's kind of smooth and correlated and things, but that's just because of the figure. In practice, it's fits to the actual individual pixel measurements from the detector.
Okay, cool. Before we take a break, do you want to say something about the exercise code? Maybe share it on your screen and just, you know, sure. Give an idea of where are we going?
Yeah, sure. Let me pull it up here. Got it. So I think you did post a link to the GitHub repository, I think, on the website. Or
I did. I okay. both put your GitHub and I also put on the course GitHub. So yeah. Everybody just git pull. And I even put the data on GitHub okay. because then they get it with git pull. But I also linked the data to the course webpage. So it's all good. Linking and available.
Well, shortly before I connected, I pushed one last little change. So you might want people could pull that from either mine or the course repository. But yeah, let me pull it up here and just show
you. You did a small change. Did you already submit it? Because then I'm going to update.
Yes, I think I pushed it all. Let me check. Okay, there's and I'll push in case I had missed something. But I can pull it up here now.
Cool. I'll copy while you show.
Okay. Yeah, so it's fairly short. I just wanted to give kind of a few details of how I do some of the things that I showed in the presentation. This is it here. Okay. So at the beginning, I use a couple spaces scikit image. I'm not sure if that's part of your Python distribution, but that usually installs pretty easily with pip or conda or something. I just wanted to show a couple examples of this kind of how this stacking is done in the terms of weighted averages. So in general, we have, you know, essentially every pixel of these images can have a different uncertainty because of maybe some of them have been masked for some reason. Maybe the, you know, the background might be slightly different. So anyway, you essentially generally have arrays of both the intensity measured on the sky and also the uncertainty given in this, units of sigma. But I used throughout, and I think I just wanted to make a point and emphasize a few places how, you know, you can turn this into a weight of, you know, inverse variance weights, and that's a convenient way of, you know, stacking and combining a lot of the these images. Some tests with the, you know, just verifying that that works on random numbers. But then an example now of actually looking at a sequence of images from a different telescope, actually, but just to show these noise properties of a field in this area. So this first thing here, Scuba 2, is the name of the detector, and I've made a three-dimensional array, which is just, in this case, there's 275 exposures and a small thumbnail, 72 pixels on a side, that are just 275 independent exposures of the sky, of the single position on the sky, that you can then stack together to, you know, this is what an individual image looks like. And then when you make this weighted average, then, you know, you actually now see the sources emerge when you stack them all together. And then there's a few tests, you know, essentially what I just wanted to show and emphasize throughout is these various tests of normality or Gaussianity, like the example that I showed and that we just discussed in the presentation. So you can, you know, test that these uncertainty images that accompany the intensity images are actually reasonable estimates of the uncertainty in these things.
At the risk sorry for breaking in, but I can see that you run the Anderson-Darling test.
That
I mentioned briefly, as if you want to test for Gaussianity, this is the best. You can of course just do a fit, and that's also nice. But cool.
Frankly, I don't use it all that much myself, but you know, these types of exercises, you always come across things like, well, yeah, maybe I should use this more often. And I think that's it. So I show that test in a few places, and I think there's an example at the end. I think that's actually kind of interesting that I'll let people get to, and we can maybe talk about it together in the exercise of why the statistics that you derive from the HST image from the Anderson-Darling test may or may not actually, you know, be supported by Anderson-Darling, and why that might actually be. So we can talk a little bit about that as we go through the exercise. There's an example here of, you know, because this is essentially a time sequence of all these different images that you stack together, you can calculate, you know, does the fact that the noise, you know, the noise goes down by the square root of t, is that true? It does, it seems to be. So you can verify that as you you know, you stack different sequences of the images. That's what this figure shows here. And then there's some examples with the Hubble data. So there's a couple of the different NumPy pickle files that have these little cutouts of the Hubble data. So I give you four of these filters. They have these kind of funny names. It just corresponds to the effective wavelength that the filter sees in microns. So 1 micron, 1.2, et cetera. An image of what the point spread function looks like in these different filters, so you can just get a sense of what they look like. So, you know, any star will look like this on the detector just because of the optics of the telescope. And these are the crosses, typically diffraction spikes of the arms holding the secondary mirror in the telescope. And then a little calculation to make a thresholded image where you do this convolution that I was saying before, where you convolve your image, your weighted image with the PSF, and that effectively gives you an image which something like the, you know, what would the intensity of a point source be at any position in the image? And then you can use that to threshold to, you know, first threshold the image and then also do the segmentation. And then there's just another, there's a couple more Henderson-Darling tests you'll see. And then the last little bit there is also in the data set, there's a model that I fit to the actual GNZ11 galaxy. So it's not actually a point source. It's slightly resolved in that it's a little bit extended. And so the last little bit shows how you can just do a direct fit of, you have this 2D model of the galaxy, and you can fit that to the data in this sort of weighted least squares, and to use that to measure the brightness. And if you should, hopefully you can use that too. If you have these four filters, you can measure the brightness in these four filters and make this little plot of wavelength versus flux, and it should show you this step function like we saw with the for the high redshift solution. But that's pretty much it for the exercises.
Cool, very much. Thanks very much. I think we all deserve a break. So let's take that now.